WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Greetings and welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm your host, Jason Mann. And before I get to my guest, I want to tell you a little bit about GredunzaPress.com. It's a sponsor of the program, and it's a wonderful way if you are interested in joining the wonderful world of wrestling podcasting. It's a great for your sites and your hosting needs. It's run by Kay Sawyer Paul, the trusted friend of WrestleSpective and Fair to Flair, of course. So if you are interested in that and or just want to support the podcast, you should definitely check out GredunzaPress.com. And my guest today for the first time on the program, David McKinney of South Atlanta Wrestling. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Good. You're welcome. And we're doing something special for this program. We are putting all of the different matches that we could possibly get onto a wheel. And I am now going to spin the wheel. And so I'm spinning the wheel. That's the sound of the wheel spinning. That's not me doing a sound effect. All right. It has landed on Jake the Snake Roberts versus Sting at Halloween Havoc 1992. Spin the wheel, make the deal, coal miner's glove match. And it's very fortunate that it was that, because that's the one that I prepared for. So,
yep, sounds good.
Yay. So, yeah. So, this is into the era of probably the peak, I would say, of the Bill Watts era of WCW, which lasted roughly mid-1992 through early 1993. For those who don't know, I've covered the territory in other shows, but just kind of a brief summary. Bill Watts was the man in charge of he was also a famous wrestler, then was the promoter of Mid-South Wrestling in the 80s, which was one of the really highly lauded territories that was, you know, just extremely ahead of its time in terms of creativity and week-to-week storytelling and so on and so forth. But he had been out of wrestling for a few years, was brought into WCW. He was also a gruff, tough-minded, old-school traditionalist, kind of was a little bit out of touch, you might say. Certain things like instituting a ban on top rope moves, and would do things that you could see the logic in doing them, but they just showed sort of a lack of keeping up with the times of modern wrestling and where wrestling was going to go. And a couple of the big moves that during his time happen on the same show, actually. August 2nd, 1992, which is where Jake Roberts debuts by attacking Sting, who has helped his friend Nikita Koloff fend off an attack from Cactus Jack and Rick Rude. Then Jake Roberts slithers in and nails him with a couple of DDTs onto a chair, almost gets the snake out of the bag and puts it on him, but luckily a horde of good guys come out and prevent him from doing so. Very, very hot debut. It's in Baltimore. The crowd is rabid. It was during a live event, but they, you know, showed it later on TV, and it's on YouTube. It's really exciting. And it also, in addition to leading to the Roberts Sting feud over the next couple of months, also takes Sting out of the WCW title rematch against Vader, in which Ron Simmons is chosen to replace him, and Ron Simmons wins the WCW title. Another very memorable moment, kind of out of the Bill Watts playbook of getting behind a top African American star, and he had that great success with that with a Junkyard Dog in the early 80s. Trying it again with Ron Simmons doesn't really work out as well, but it is a certainly a memorable moment, at least with the title win. And you were saying that was one that you really those are a couple moments that you really remember.
Right, this was kind of on that time when I thought I had outgrown wrestling, but I was still kind of paying attention. 6:05 Saturday night down here, especially in Atlanta, Georgia, or south of Atlanta, Georgia, is a big deal. So, still paying attention. And I know, that Ron Simmons winning the world title out of nowhere was a complete, it was a complete mark out moment for me and for that crowd, in all honesty. And seeing Jake slither into the ring and destroy Sting, even though I was a big Sting fan, was just really exciting as well to see Jake the Snake Roberts come to my hometown promotion.
Right. And, WCW had not really brought in a lot of, WWF stars and used them in that way. I mean, Rick Rude would be the other memorable one, also against Sting, about a year before. But really, it wasn't. That wasn't common for WCW to do really up until, Hogan in 94. And that was, obviously a completely different thing. But it's interesting that that didn't happen. I guess there were not necessarily that many, not as many opportunities to do that, at least on that level. I mean, there were guys, like mid-card guys, like Paul Orndorff, had a good long run in WCW. And there's certainly other guys who had WWE runs, but I'm talking guys who primarily made their names in WWF.
Right. Around that time, of course, when WCW was struggling like that, most of the, big debuts were guys like Ric Flair coming back, Arn Anderson coming back. It felt really different and special to have a guy as big as Jake the Snake, who is, as some people say, he was at some points probably right behind Hogan in popularity in WWE as a face, even though he'd been so successful as a heel, he could do everything. It just seemed like such a big deal for WCW at that time. Like you said, now the whole playbook changed once Hogan came in, and then, you got Brutus and Greg Valentine and the Nasty Boy.
Sure.
Things changed at that point. But yeah, at this point during the Watts era, it really did feel like a big, special deal. And my opinion could have been skewed because, Jake's billed from Stone Mountain, Georgia. And I was just a huge fan, but it really, even looking back, it just seems like it was a big deal at the time. Unfortunately, it didn't pan out necessarily the way we would have liked.
Sure, sure. And Roberts, he was coming off of a pretty hot run as a heel in late 91, early 92. Now, he'd lost pretty decisively at WrestleMania that year to The Undertaker, but he was still, he was still, obviously he understood how to get heat and understood, just wrestling psychology was amazing at, and was instantly over, obviously, by by years of equity of being a huge star and, as just being an awesome performer. So, I will say that what has not aged very well during that time is Jake's leather suit and cowboy boots that he is wearing. That's not necessarily a good look for him. And I feel like I remember him wearing something reasonably similar during his Snake Pit interview days.
Oh, I think he had pleated pants with a shirt that was open, but tied kind of above the waist. I hate to say a woman typically would wear.
Yeah.
I believe in that. It might even be when Honky Tonk cracks him with a guitar, but yeah, looking back, there are some very questionable fashion moments for the Snake.
Yeah, the Snake, he was a master of wrestling psychology, but fashion psychology was not quite as good with.
And did he not wear something that might resemble a Cosby sweater at least once? I think I seem to recall a Cosby sweater or two.
That's during the Hogan Andre build. There's definitely a Cosby sweater in one of those, you know, where Hogan is interviewed by Roberts. I feel like it's during that time. Maybe it's later in 87. Because obviously the primary angles for Hogan Andre were Piper's Pit, but I feel like maybe, you know, a Snake Pit might have been involved there as well. I can't remember if they had Snake Pit while they Piper's Pit or if Snake Pit came along after Piper's Pit. I feel like they did Snake Pit when Roberts was a heel, so it had to have been around during that time as well. Anyway, we are digressing, but so Jake Roberts, after that, is basically involved in, you know, some squash matches, some tag matches, and house shows. There's one good squash match against Marcus Alexander Bagwell on WCW Saturday Night with Cactus Jack just being, like, really great on commentary and showing his admiration for Jake Roberts and how much he loves this man and how much he, you know, wants to worship at his feet, which just makes me, like, really wish Roberts had stuck around longer and he and Cactus could have had, like, you know, a team or a stable or whatever. That would have just been so, so incredible, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And not to digress too much, but, you know, I did we did a fantasy draft one year, and my first round pick was Jake Roberts, in part because I knew he could play the face so well, in part because I knew he could play heel so well, and in part because I knew he could play a figure kind of like you're hinting at right there with Cactus Jack, kind of like CM Punk with the Straight Edge Society. I mean, he just gives you that versatility. You know, you could definitely buy Jake the Snake Roberts as a cult leader type if that's what you wanted to book in your promotion.
Right. Yeah, I think I know on Twitter I once did like a best possible version of Dungeon of Doom, and I came with like a lot of ideas, but I think Jake Roberts and Cactus were definitely on that short list. You know, with everyone having to kind of fill like the certain role that you had in Dungeon of Doom, Roberts obviously being the leader of that.
Right. Well, and you know, you obviously there was a lot of people who thought he was going to be the higher power for some reason in the big Undertaker Ministry deal when you know, Vince McMahon was revealed. I don't really know why people thought that, but you know, it speaks to the charismatic nature and of that character, right? That people thought that made sense.
He'd be good at it, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And that was pre Wrestling with Shadows, so you know, I don't think people knew the extent of Jake Roberts's personal issues, you know, until that movie came out. So, or I'm sorry, not Wrestling with Shadows, but Beyond the Mat.
Beyond the Mat, yes, sir.
And also, of course, the Jake Roberts Marcus Bagwell is Marietta versus Stone Mountain, Georgia. So, you know, important battle for them.
That's right.
You know. I used to live near Stone Martin. Yeah, I used to live near Stone Martin Mountain, not Martin. I worked in Marietta, so I know that area a little bit. You know,
that's pretty cool. As the name of the blog implies, I'm not from South Atlanta. I'm from south of Atlanta, technically. A little town called Sonoya, where The Walking Dead is filmed. My town doubles as Woodbury on The Walking Dead.
Nice.
So.
Cool.
Yeah, pretty cool.
So there's also a really good, or I've been told is good, I've not been able to check out yet, a Dustin Rhodes versus Jake Roberts, like 15-minute long match from WCW Saturday Night, which is closer to the Halloween Havoc match itself. So, which I'm looking forward to checking out.
Yeah, that sounds good. Was did Dustin and Barry hold the tag titles when this match took place? I assume, or no? Do you know?
Didn't they win them at Halloween Havoc, or did they? No, they won them before. They won them.
They definitely defended them at Halloween Havoc, but I don't know the time frame beyond that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I was just curious.
Not when that exactly happened. I'm not. I think they were, but I'm not absolutely sure about that.
We'll have to track down that match and find out now,
well,
won't we?
I will include a link to it on in the show notes, because everyone I'm sure will be very curious about that match. And then there is an elimination tag at the September 2nd, 1992, which is the famous Clash of the Champions 20, also the 20th anniversary celebration of wrestling being on TBS, one of the more memorable Clash shows. And it's a 8-man elimination tag match with Roberts and Sting on the opposite sides. Roberts ends up pinning Sting at the end with a DDT, although he is aided by Vader, who has hit an illegal top rope splash on Sting to weaken him. So, and also there's this note on, I was looking through the history of WWE.com for notes, on, you know, what had happened here, as I often do. Very useful site. Everyone should, I'm sure if you listen to this podcast, you know about the history of WWE.com, but for some reason, if you don't, you should go there and nerd out. Anyway, on the, September 5th house show in Dallas at the Sportatorium, I'm going to quote what the note says. During the show, an elderly man, accompanied by his personal nurse, attempted to shoot Jake Roberts. The man had attended shows at the Sportatorium for 30 years without incident. So this guy apparently was, you know, taking it pretty seriously.
It sounds like it, and I guess that speaks to the snake's ability to get you to believe what you're seeing.
Yeah. Although apparently this happened before the spin the wheel, make the deal. I don't know what you call it. I guess a vignette from which would have been leading to the Halloween Havoc. Because if he had watched that, he would not have believed that wrestling was real. After that, he would definitely, it's like 7 minutes long. It really does need to be watched to be seen, because it's just like one of those, like for everything that was kind of going on good here in WCW, at least creative wise, they had stuff like this that was just like overly cheesy and just ridiculous. And it's the type of thing that in WWE today, it wouldn't be as big of a deal because wrestling has changed so much. And this sort of thing, this sort of campy, goofy thing, is just kind of accepted as part of what it is. And there are people who would hate it, and it may be a negative, but it's not the same type of thing as it would have been in 1992, when wrestling was still, you know, there were goofy things, but it was wrestling was still in the veneer of being, you know, being grounded as a sport, especially WCW. So, you know, it's this. You know, this, you set the scene with full moon and sirens, it's pitch black, and then they're in some sort of like spooky warehouse, like party type thing with these like sexy vampire ladies walking around, and then you have all these bikers chanting, spin the wheel, make the deal. You have this dude randomly in a Hannibal Lecter mask, people cleaning off their knives, and Jake Roberts sort of smiling, and everyone, like, they're picking out weapons. And then Medusa's there, dressed as a sexy vampire. Sting shows up in his biker jacket, and then Sting and Roberts sort of trade back and forth these cheesy lines, which Roberts does his best with, but it's just like so corny and so silly that it's hard to take seriously. And then it's capped off by the wheel being spun, and then suddenly we see lasers colliding from Jake's and Sting's eyes. And we have a Halloween Havoc, promo for the pay-per-view. And that is what it is.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing I noticed in the like you said, I'm a big fan of in wrestling, whether it's somehow creatively or production-wise or whatever. If you can't do something well, just keep it simple. That's kind of my take on things if I were running things. Those graphics to begin that show were pretty dreadful. I was always a big fan, for some reason, of the Halloween Havoc logo, the way it radiated. I shouldn't say radiated, the way the light came off of it, and they usually like kind of turned it into place. I think that was kind of cool. But, you know, even the dopey spin the wheel thing and how cheesy it looked, I mean, compare it to something that was just about equally over the top, was Jake training the Ultimate Warrior to take on The Undertaker. Now, those were cheesy and over the top. but they kind of were.
Yeah.
This was cheesy and over the top, and it was absolutely ridiculous. Like, there was nothing redeeming about it at all. I mean, there's a lot of absurdity in Bury Me, Snake Man, but it was not as ridiculous, and it kind of managed to stay on that side of, okay, this is this is wrestling. I can deal with this. Whereas the spin the wheel vignette was just like, 100% absurd.
Right. I mean, I think it's just the way that it's shot. You know, it's the way that it's presented. It's just so separated from reality. It's like, okay, this is like, just completely separate from it or whatever. It was just such a weird thing to do. And just kind of contradicts the rest of the story almost. Like, it just sort of, like, it undermines the rest of the story. So.
Yeah, it takes you right out of it.
Exactly.
You know? Like I said, even the dopey graphics, the way I didn't mind the Havoc logo and all that and the way it transitioned in, but, like, you know, the little haunted house that they, you know, the really bad-looking computer graphics, just if you can't do it well, don't do it, you know?
Yeah. And then one more a couple more things. There's kind of a cool and I couldn't find video of it, but there's a description of Bill Watts recapping the history of the Lights Out match and talking about, like, all the different promotions that were part of the NWA, and then that, you know, all the different promoters were pushing the parameters to try to make things more exciting, and talking about, like, Texas Death Match and Russian Chain Match and Bull Rope Match, and then all these different, you know, types of matches that were created to do it. And then the idea is of the Lights Out match, which this the spin the wheel make the deal match was technically a Lights Out match, the idea being that you symbolically turn off the lights and then turn them back on to indicate that the last match, the show is over, but the last match is not sanctioned. And that's just kind of a neat little way to sort of to bring it up and to kind of bring, you know, to kind of bring the idea of it, even though, you know, the whole idea of you being able to see an unsanctioned match and a referee being there, that all seems kind of, you know, silly, but that's a decent way of connecting it to history and using history in, like, an enhancing way.
Right. And like you said, you know, it certainly is kind of silly, but, you know, really an Irish whip is silly. You know, there's certain amounts of silliness that at least I, as a fan, am willing to accept, as long as it's kind of, the internal logic's kind of consistent, you know. I mean, yeah, unsanctioned matches do bring up a whole can of worms, just a whole lot of issues that you're like, well, wait, if this was really unsanctioned, like you said, why is this on a pay-per-view? Yeah. Why is there a ref there? Why doesn't Jake just choke Sting to death?
Can the timekeeper sue if he gets hurt by one of the competitors?
Right. You know, why is the ref counting him, telling him to get off the ropes?
Sure.
I mean, you know, there's any number of things, but, you know, I can live with that in, you know, in the realm of a professional wrestling environment.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of like the whole definition of obscenity thing. It's like, you know, it when you see it, it's hard to define, like, what is too ridiculous in wrestling. And obviously that standard is very different for each individual person, but they're definitely, it has to do with the framing, you know, it has to do with lots of things, but I think the framing is very important.
Right. I would definitely agree with that. You know, I'm certainly not a fan who just sits back and enjoys the show. I mean, maybe I'd be a lot happier with everything if I could, but I do like to analyze things. But some of the stuff that people, like, really get, you know, nitty gritty about, it just doesn't really appeal to me. To, like, some of the things I see tweeted during, like, a Raw, for example, I just think that's just kind of silly to point out, you know, whatever that thing is. But then there's something else that you might think is completely absurd that I'm just completely bent out of shape about. You know, it's just funny where it doesn't seem to be a real clearly defined for any one person, like, well, this is absurd, so this should be more absurd. I might be okay with one absurd thing, and you might look at something else and say, well, that's absolutely insane, but this is pretty
right,
cool.
Right.
You know?
And then there's a great contract signing, although the contract signing is less about the match and more about both guys signing the contract to absolve WCW of any liability. Of course, Jake and Sting are there, and Bill Watts is there. Jake is in his best track suit, another fine fashion choice by Jake. Although he does a really awesome job of just like getting in Sting's head, and Sting is sort of Sting's never really been the best verbally, but just kind of the facial expressions, not really being over the top, but just sort of like indicating not really fear, but a little bit of concern on in his face. You know, I think he does a nice job of conveying that. And then they sort of make a big deal about one of the choices being a spinner's choice. And then that does not, and that's really the dominating theme of the segment, which, you know, it's one of the last segments before the actual show. And of course the spinner's choice does not come into play at all during the match or you know, during the spin, on the show. So, it makes me wonder what the point of doing that was.
You can say that about a lot of WCW.
Or a lot of wrestling, you know, yeah.
In general. Right.
On to the show itself. Before the match, we will get into the actual spinning of the wheel, which is very important. Sting comes out, and the Halloween Havoc skull that in the background has lights coming from its eyes that are in sync with the rhythm of Sting's music, which, you know, is a nice attention to detail.
Yes, that's not a bad touch,
yeah.
Actually.
Of course, Sting is out there to spin the wheel. I can only assume that Jake Roberts was, you know, too out of his mind to perform the task. So, although Jake is clean, you know, or apparently is clean these days, so good for him. Hopefully that keeps up.
Certainly hope so.
Yeah. And we get some fireworks and some special music as the wheel's prepared. Sting just sort of stands there for a while. I guess the tech guys are sort of working on it. Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura sort of just chatter about things and chatter about, you know, strategy and so on and so forth. Nothing really super interesting. There are like plastic snakes around the wheel. There's also the skull in the background. And all of those have flashing lights from their eyes. Tony's out there and then tells Sting, okay, go ahead and spin the wheel. So he pulls the lever. There's a bit of a delay of it starting to spin. It finally does. And the wheel gets its pyro and it sort of just spins around. And then it lands on Coal Miner's Glove match, which gets absolutely no reaction from the crowd because I doubt any of them have ever heard of a Coal Miner's Glove match.
Yeah, I don't think I had ever heard of one until this. Now, you know, I was, I don't know, 14 at the time, but I had never heard of a Coal Miner's Glove before
that. And it was sort of popular in some of the southern territories. I think it's more Tennessee and maybe in Mid-South, I suppose, where it's basically a glove on a pole. And the Coal Miner's Glove is, I guess, a steel or something. I mean, it's basically like a loaded glove, essentially. So, and it is sort of weird to have this be a Coal Miner's Glove match when you have like cage matches and I Quit matches and matches that, you know, this isn't something that the fans are necessarily going to get as excited about.
Right. And one thing I noticed too was Jesse Ventura, I think when he was running down the list of matches, he mentioned Coal Miner's Glove match first, which I'm not saying means anything at all. Obviously, he had to mention something first, but it kind of caught my ear that I'm fairly certain that when he was doing the rundown, he mentioned Coal Miner's Glove as a possibility, and this was before they spun the wheel. And honestly, it really is a minor thing, but as I was watching it, like you kind of mentioned the technical hiccup with the wheel, that whole thing, just the way the wheel spun, looked very odd to me.
Yeah, like it sort of, like they were saying it was slowing down, but it really just sort of like, it didn't operate like you're spinning the wheel and it goes fast and then just sort of slows down and get there. It operated like, you know, someone was controlling it and then hit a button to stop it, basically. So, I don't know. It was odd. I don't know. You know, I don't know how hard it is to rig a wheel or whatever, but I don't want to like get too technical about it, but just it's like one of those things that like doesn't come across as, I don't know, it comes across as odd.
Right. And I've heard speculation that some people think that they didn't actually rig the wheel at all, and they literally just let it spin and land on whatever, which would be the first time in history a wrestling company didn't work something. And in this case, they probably should have.
I feel like that's impossible. That can't be true, though, because, I mean,
I'm with you.
Like, I mean, they would have had to have, like, a cage ready to go if it were going to be a cage match. And they would have had to have...
I thought they actually did.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Maybe I fell for something here. I thought they actually mentioned it and or showed it.
Okay.
They definitely mentioned it, of course, but I thought they actually might have showed a cage.
That would make sense, actually. I don't remember seeing that.
It still wouldn't make sense that they, you know, wouldn't, you know, gimmick the wheel,
right,
though. I mean, I'm with you there, so I'm certainly not arguing that.
I tried looking for, because Bill Watts has done a lot of interviews, and I tried looking for something on him explaining what the deal was with Coal Miner's Glove. Either I couldn't find it or he hasn't been asked. But I can't believe he's never been asked that question. But either way, it was not immediately available. So if anyone does know, if anyone has heard him talk about it and explain that, please tweet me, because I would be very curious to hear. But either way, we have some Twitter questions regarding it, and I guess I'll just go ahead and say it now. My thought is that the reason they chose it is because this was not originally intended to be the final match of the Robert Sting feud, so they didn't want to go with something too definitive.
I could certainly see that. And honestly, as much as we are kind of dumping on the Coal Miner's Glove match, I could see how the concept has potential. The execution in this one, and I'm sure we'll talk about it maybe a little more later, but the execution was a little lacking, but I could certainly see how the concept of a Coal Miner's Glove match could work.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that different from a ladder match, I guess. Or like a WWF style cage match where there's a lot of climbing. I mean, the idea of getting up to something and, obviously, Sting and especially Jake aren't going to be doing that kind of bumping like you would do in a ladder match. But I mean, you have a similar template.
Right. The problem really comes in on the back end, which, I guess once we talk about the finish of the match, the problem comes in on the back end with how they use the Coal Miner's Glove didn't make a ton of sense to
right.
me.
But. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, let's get to the match. Jake Roberts is out first, and I do have to say that Jake has looked more physically fit. Of course, he's looked worse, but he is definitely a little hefty here. And for some reason to me, his mustache looks extra fluffy.
Yeah, I think he might have conditioned that thing.
I think you might be right, yes. There. I believe there was some conditioning going on. Sting is quite fit, however, as usual. The pole is very, very high. It's like 25 feet up or so.
Yeah, I honestly, and for those of you who haven't seen this match recently, I was shocked how tall the pole was when I flipped this match on. I really was.
Yeah, it's a very tall pole. So, Ross points out that there's a doctor there, presumably in case of a snake bite, although Jesse mentions, well, why worry about it since Roberts didn't bring out his bag, which is odd that he didn't bring it out. And I don't I think the snake was banned after this, not at this point.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think there was any ban on the snake. So the fact they didn't bring it out when he brings it out every time was sort of an odd decision.
Yeah, certainly. Now, one thing I noticed in the pre-match, and this is a time-honored tradition, both guys went over and checked the pole, which to me is a very small detail that makes a lot of sense. You know, if this is a true competition, it would make sense that Jake and Sting would go over there and, you know, try to get a feel for what they're going to have to deal with later in this match. I like those little things. I watch wrestling and look for those little things.
Yeah, that's a good detail. And right, it is just a little thing, but it does kind of give you a it, it it's it's a thread that you can, you know, that you can pick up, and it's nice. Jesse calls Sting the most popular wrestler in the world, and it's interesting that Jesse never had the same sort of hate for Sting like he did for Hogan.
Yeah, he plays it a lot straighter, it seems like, in his WCW commentary, from what I recall of it. I mean, obviously he leans a little bit towards the heel side, but it doesn't seem to be overwhelming, which I think helped make him a good commentator. But, you know, of course, certainly we know that there's some history there between Jesse and Hulk behind the scenes that may have attributed to that.
Sure.
Or it could have been direction from Vince McMahon. We know how he likes to get in the ear of his commentators.
Right.
It is an interesting point that he seems to pay Sting on the air. He seems to pay Sting a little more respect than he ever did with the Hulkster.
Yeah, I mean, and he would bring up, you know, like I feel like he would occasionally compliment Hogan, but it was like 80-90%, you know, of, you know, oh, Hogan does all this, and he didn't bring up a whole lot of negatives on Sting. Maybe just differences in the characters or some of the things you suggested. But and I do think that I know from reading some of Watts's time that I think Jesse was instructed to play a little more straight than he had in the past. I think that was sort of a, you know, that Watts had a certain way he liked his announcers to be, and, you know, and Jesse was sort of instructed to conform to that to a certain extent. So that might have been part of it as well. But
if that's the case, I can certainly respect that, because I think Watts is on the right path with that idea.
I do to an extent, although I'm a really big fan of Jesse's, and I do think that I do have the notion that Jesse, as a frequent critic of Hogan, that was good for stemming some of the Hogan backlash that could have occurred without there being that voice that was critical of Hogan on WWE TV having a fairly prominent place.
Oh, that's an excellent point. I never thought about it that way.
Cena has never had that. And I wonder if that would make a difference in how fans see Cena. If there were, like, even Cole as a heel was usually complimentary of Cena and was usually positive towards Cena. Didn't bring up, like, you know, didn't criticize Cena ever as, like, arrogant or as cocky or as playing by his own rules or whatever, even when Cena acted in that way. So I don't know. I mean, it's just a theory of mine. It may have made no difference whatsoever, but I've always wondered if that, if Jesse playing that role, you know, made any difference.
Well, it's a fascinating idea, because it's certainly true that part of Cena's problem is that he's got the corporate stink on him.
Yeah.
As in, you know, people seem to react to the fact that he's the company guy. And, you know, a lot of folks, especially rebellious, you know, wrestling fans don't really appreciate the company guy maybe the way they should.
Sure, sure. And they've obviously, and you know, it doesn't need to be said that WWE's obviously made the split reaction for Cena work for them, and it, you know, it's not really a problem, so to speak. Although occasionally it leads to reactions they don't like or that don't really help the match, but still, you know, it is interesting to wonder if there were a Ventura type announcer, if that would have made any difference. But anyway, so Jake immediately tries to sort of be sneaky and catch Sting off guard and go get the glove, but Sting catches him right away, lands a couple of body slams. Sting tries for it too, but Jake pulls him down. He even shakes his shame finger at Sting, the shame on you finger. So Sting then ducks a punch, lands one of his own. Robert catches a headlock. Sting's able to get a leapfrog, but then misses a dropkick. Jake then goes right after Sting's back with repeated knees. They end up at the outside, and Jake tries to send Sting in the post, but then ends up nailing it with his arm. And then Sting, he, I believe, goes back inside and then sneaks back out again and then rams Jake's arm into the post twice again. I will say that Sting is not particularly sporting here, although I do have to grant that Sting, this is a guy who DDT'd him into a chair twice and, you know, has been, you know, his violent enemy for a couple of months. So I guess it isn't necessarily incumbent upon Sting to be fair-minded here, especially in a match without any rules. But it did seem like Sting was being a little bit more villainous than usual. Not openly villainous, but just a little bit more edgy, we'll say.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, my thing with as it relates to faces like that, and this has been a big discussion lately with the way faces act in this day and age. You know, I think the thing with Sting back then was at least you could see it was like you touched on, it was a righteous anger. So if he, you know, if he colored outside the lines a little bit in his attacks on Jake, at least you felt that it was completely justified.
Right.
And I do recall that spot where he went, like he got in the ring, went out of the ring. There was something really wonky about that, and I would have to look at it again, I hate to say, but there's something really wonky about that whole thing. I couldn't figure out exactly what Sting was trying to accomplish there.
Well, normally that would be like a breaking the count, but there's no count during it. Now that may just be like a oh he forgot because his instinct is to do it kind of thing. But the announcers didn't touch on it, so it wasn't really a big deal. But yeah, you're right. It was a little bit odd.
Which could be like, you know, like you said, it's probably a guy on autopilot thinking, you know, this is how we always work these matches. Now you're working a match in a completely different style that you don't work very often. Certainly could happen.
Yeah.
And I also remember noting at this point that it seemed awfully early for Jake to do the shoulder spot into the post. I thought that was kind of interesting that he, you know, looked to be injured that early in the match.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, that the arm injury plays through the, I mean, it's an important element of the rest of the match. And it's odd. Yeah. It would make more sense for Sting to be selling an injury rather than Jake. Just, you know, given normal psychologies for the heel to go after the injured body part and to work it over and then the babyface to make a comeback. And I would say that this is more of a 50-50. You know, match of, you know, each guy taking about half of it rather than the heel taking, you know, whatever 70 or 80 or whatever percent that is, you know, kind of a more typical match. But yeah, it is sort of interesting. Sting then goes for the glove, but Jake is able to recover, keeps him from doing so with a back suplex. Jake shakes his injured arm while after doing that, though, and then Sting ends up getting a hammerlock and working the arm for a while. Jesse, on commentary, obviously, openly wonders whether either guy would have chosen this match if they'd had the choice and whether it favored either of them. There's not really any conclusion there, but I guess an interesting point to bring up. Then later he has a what if of what if they never neither of them gets the glove, because the glove, it doesn't need to be gotten, it just sort of is there, it can be used. I don't know if these were just things that were brought up because of lack of other things to say. There was not, you know, these were sort of during slower moments during the match, but I don't know if Jesse was maybe like hinting in his own way that this wasn't much of a match or that this wasn't much of a stipulation and was just sort of, you know, bringing these things up, or if he just, again, just saying it to fill time. But I found those bits of commentary interesting.
Yeah, I think especially in this day and age, when you get so little of that, like true color commentary, what, you know, color commentary should be, I found it really refreshing. You kind of stole my thunder a little bit, because that was the one line that I actually jotted down. The line about Jesse Ventura where he said that and wondered if this would have been the option that these guys would have chosen, I thought was brilliant. I mean, it really, you know, just kind of added to the drama of the match, I thought, just in the sense, just to give you something to wonder about, something to engage you as a fan to think about.
Yep.
You know, and there was another thing that is pretty standard for commentary, but you don't necessarily hear it as much anymore. I think it was Jim Ross who said something to the effect of Jake won't rest until Sting is eliminated from the sport. I mean, you know, it's a simple throwaway line, but it really does help, you know, build a little more build a little more intrigue into the match or the feud, or, you know, brings it a little more heat.
Yeah, it gives, you know, you, there's a goal that Jake Roberts has. Like, he wants to accomplish something, where a lot of feuds, there's not really like an ill, it's not as defined. I mean, obviously the one guy wants to hurt the other guy, or the one guy wants revenge, but it's nice to have stakes. It's nice to have some sort of, you know, it's nice to have that hook, even if it's something simple. You know, it's at least something like, okay, I get what the stakes of this match or what the stakes of this feud are. So,
right. And I think it's something that really should be used more often. I mean, if you got a match that's not necessarily part of a feud, you know, say on a Raw or whatever, you know, just say, you know, both these guys are trying to climb their way up the ladder to, you know, get a title shot, you know, say something, explain why this should matter.
Yeah. And I think it's something simple like that can add a little bit more to, you know, it can give you a little bit of a hook into a match you might not otherwise be interested in. Again, it's, you know, it's not like it's not a big thing. It's not necessarily like a, you know, gonna work with everybody, but it is just a little added extra thing that takes almost no effort.
Right. It buys you something and costs you
right,
nothing.
Exactly. At this point, Roberts is able to get out of the hammerlock, and he hip tosses Sting over the top, although Sting stays on the apron. Then Sting immediately is able to crotch Jake near the pole. Jesse says that Jake is a Soprano now. Then Sting steps on Jake's head and stomps him repeatedly, then works the arm some more. The stepping on the head and stomping was also some more viciousness on Sting's part. Then finally Jake's able to toss Sting out. Then he nails him on the shoulder with the chair on the outside. Jesse then brings up that he thinks it's time for the DDT. Jake chokes Sting with the wrist tape. And then Jesse points out that the ref can't do anything about it, although then the ref sort of does break it up. Jesse questions why. The ref says that maybe it's instinct. And then Jesse sort of admonishes Jake for allowing the ref to take the tape away. But then Ross sort of says, well, maybe Jake, you know, thinks that he has Sting here and he's not willing to fight it, which I thought was a good line from Ross.
Right. And, you know, honestly, at this point, and I probably should save this for later. I keep saying that I should. But I thought it was interesting. Like, really, at this point, I was completely falling in love with the commentary on this match. Like, the MVPs of the match to this point, and actually by the time I finished it, were the announcers. And I don't know if it's just, you know, again, because it's refreshing, because it's, you know, so different from what we see nowadays. But I really enjoyed Jesse and JR's work here in this match.
Yeah, I thought they were good, and it's interesting because there's, you know, you know, they played up that Ross and Ventura didn't particularly like each other, didn't really have the same sort of philosophies on commentary, and so forth. But I mean, obviously, both are among the best at what they did, and I thought they, you know, at least here they fit pretty well. And as I recall, you know, most of the shows they did commentary on, I felt like they fit pretty well. So, you know, and although I thought Tony and Jesse were a good team as well, and seemed to kind of have more of, had a little bit more maybe chemistry with each other in terms of like kind of playing off of each other's, you know, particularly Jesse's jokes, you know. But I, you know, Ross and Jesse were definitely excellent here. And I agree that the match itself, you know, isn't necessarily bad, but there's not a whole lot of depth to it. So the commentary gives it a nice little, extra something, which is, you know, what commentary should do.
Absolutely.
So Robert, hits a running knee lift, but then sort of loses his balance and falls on his head. But Sting sells as though he has been hit with it. I don't know if that was a miscommunication or if Jake really did lose his balance or that was just how it was planned, but it looked kind of weird. Robertson's up in the corner. Sting misses a stinger splash, and then Jake hits a short clothesline, but his arm is in pain because, of course, the arm pain earlier. He calls for the DDP, which gets a pop. Then Jake lands the DDT again with his arm, causing more pain to his arm, but he hits the DDT. He climbs the pole and shakes his arm while he's doing it. So slow to climb the pole. Sting gets up really quickly from the DDT. He does convey that he's groggy for a bit. Jake elbows him away, but then Sting jumps around the pole, like basically from one side of the pole to the other, like on the ring apron, which is a cool looking spot. Sort of uses the pole to swing himself, and socks Roberts down. But it's weird that Jake or that Sting really did not sell the DDT for very long at all.
Yeah, and it wasn't just you, because I also had that in my notes, which I will also make available somehow, just so people can kind of see the raw thoughts on that I made of this match. It was kind of interesting because you and I have hit on several of the same things here, and I definitely think the spot of the night, of the match, was probably that around the pole thing. I thought it was pretty cool
Yeah, it
looking.
was cool looking, but but it was just like sort of out of place, just given like, oh yeah, and I guess I should mention for newer fans, like the DDT like was like one of those moves that had an aura around it. I mean, it was a move that when Roberts did it, until Undertaker at WrestleMania 8, I don't remember anyone ever kicking out of it. Apparently Don Carnoodle kicked out of it in 1983. So, but I was told on Twitter today. But basically, realistically, it had rarely or never been kicked out of. I mean, it was one of those moves that had like once you hit it, you're out, and that's it. The match is over or whatever. So it's to see that happen, it's kind of startling. And obviously the DDT doesn't, I mean, it's a well-liked move and well-used, and it certainly is, hits an impact, but it's rarely a finisher now, and it's doesn't certainly doesn't have the same kind of way behind it as it did when, Jake was doing it.
Right, Jake, I think, put it best. They asked him what DDT meant, and he said it means the end, and that's what it used to mean.
So, and especially just the way that, he did it and the way that he set it up, and he had the spinning his finger around to set up for it, and it was, and every time you saw it, you get excited. It's like, oh, it's a DDT. How exciting can it be? But it just in. And the way the guys took it, and I don't like the way that Sting takes it with, and a lot of guys take it this way with like the flipping over, sort of like you're taking like a, like you're rolling over, like, I liked it when guys would just take it like head first and land there flat and wouldn't, and would just, be face down on it, which might be a more dangerous way of taking it, which maybe is why guys don't take it that way. But I thought it, but as far as making it look more like impactful and making it look more devastating, I thought it was better.
Agreed. It should be more like a pile driver type, a thud, not like a I don't know.
Like the pedigree. I mean, like, people, you land flat in your face and you're dead after you're hit with pedigree.
Right. And that's another move that all depends on how people take, 'cause I think Kane takes a miserable pedigree. It looks awful, but some guys take it like a champ,
Yeah,
so.
it's yeah. And some guys have to have he has to unlock his arm, like Vince. Like he has to unlock his arms before landing on it, and that always looks kind of bad, But that's also another move that's been really well protected. So it's really, it's still a very over move. And there are very, very few guys who have kicked out of that. Same with, the Tombstone, obviously, for Undertaker. Very few guys have kicked out of that. Same way. Those are the finishers that we think of, at least that I think of as like the best, most devastating, most exciting ones because of how they've been, presented. Not necessarily because they're all that physically impressive. as much. So, let's see. At this point, Sting climbs up. He gets he or yeah. Well, while he is climbing up, Cactus Jack runs in. He gives Jake a small bag with a snake and a snake handler's glove. Sting climbs up. He gets the coal miner's glove, gets back down, and then as Jake is holding the snake, this is a smaller, more venomous snake. Sting nails Jake in the back of the ribs with the glove, and the cobra ends up, well, supposedly bites his face. Now we get some close-ups and you see that Jake's really holding the snake there and the snake is not latching on. I guess the snake was supposed to bite him and just didn't want to for whatever reason. Anyway, Jake falls back, Sting covers, we get kind of like a quick undramatic pin from the ref, and then it's over. Well, the match is over. Basically, we now have like Jake sort of like writhing in pain and holding the snake up to his face, and Jesse says he's bleeding profusely, but we don't really see any blood. Cactus doesn't really want anything to do with the snake at first, but is sort of warily helps Jake as he starts fading and is sort of crawling down the entryway. And then we basically, I don't even think we do any like Sting celebrating. We basically immediately cut to Tony and Bruno Sammartino, who chat in only the very briefest of terms, that basically they agree that this is the only the beginning of the feud and that it hasn't nothing's been settled tonight. And then we cut to Jesse and JR recapping the show, which is normally something that I like, but like no celebration from Sting at all after this, you know, kind of monumental victory, even if it's not over, is another odd choice.
Yeah, the whole thing just kind of fell flat at that point because this goes back to what I was alluding to earlier. You know, the coal miner's glove aspect of this could work, except for you didn't do anything with it. You know, one kind of weak shot, and then you got the goofy snake biting Jake, and then he gets pinned. It just didn't go anywhere. I mean, you could use that had he inflicted some real damage with the glove. Then not only do you have something for this match, you have something. If you ever want to go back to a coal miner's glove match, you dust off footage of this and say, "See, this is how vicious this match can be." Instead, it was just like it was over. It'd be like what was it ECW called them? The old their ladder matches, Stairway to Hell
Yeah.
or whatever like that, and that you'd get the kendo stick. It'd be like if you got down, hit the guy with a kendo stick one time, he falls down, you pin him, and it's over. Well, what's the purpose of
Right,
that?
exactly. Yeah, I mean, if he had like hit him with it 5 times and Jake had bled and collapsed and then Sting pinned him, even if you'd done it sort of quick after the after he got the glove, at least you get that glove like, oh wow, that glove really hurts, and like wow, you know, we beat him so quick after he got it, you know, it was kind of vicious. You're right. Yeah, that totally, if they'd done something like that, like a finish like that would have been hot. That totally would have changed my opinion of the match.
Right. I mean, you know, Sting maybe snapping a little bit, you know, just really wailing on Jake with that coal miner's glove, you know, would have been something. But like you said, not only did they kind of butcher that, then they don't even show really, they don't even focus on the fact that Sting won or how Sting feels about this or anything like that. I mean, other than the hilarious visual of Jake trying to get up the ramp with Cactus Jack, which,
Right.
like you said before, that'd be a great pairing. I'd love to see, you know, see more of. I mean, that's like, you know, it just fell flat. I keep going back to those two terms, but that's all I can think of. It
Yeah.
just fell
I mean,
flat.
you see where they were going with it with the idea, but it just didn't really, yeah, it just didn't work. Which is unfortunate because there were a lot of things on paper on like the show did was very successful in the scale of the times, and like on paper it's like a really it could have been a really good show, but like a lot of the stuff just really falls flat. Like there's a good 6-man to start it with the wonderful team of Arn Anderson, Michael Hayes, and Bobby Eaton, half of you know representing the Horsemen, Freebirds, and Midnight Express, and I guess two-thirds of them represent Dangerous Alliance. And then you have a really good Pillman Steamboat match, and then you also have like a Rick Rude Masaccio match, which is like a rematch of which is like a really mediocre rematch of like a great match. And then you have Ron Simmons against the Barbarian, which they did a decent job building up. But Barbarian, although I like him, wasn't really a guy who you felt like was deserving of a WCW title shot. And then you have, as you mentioned before, Windham and Rhodes they're both NWA and WCW tag champions. And they end up fighting Steve Williams and Steve Austin. And this was Austin was subbing for Terry Gordy, Steve Williams' longtime partner. Like they do a 30-minute draw, which is, pretty good. But another thing of like it would have probably been a more momentous match, if you would have had Gordy in there, and this was kind of like the finish of a decently long running feud with them. It was just like a show that like could have been a lot better on paper, but like everything that could have gone wrong almost did.
Yeah, it's like nothing really clicked. Even you have Rude managing to talk his way out of having to defend the U.S. title, so he brings in Vader to do it, and Vader and Nikita Koloff, I think most of us would be excited about that match, but, it just kind of, it was there. It was an interesting match. One thing that struck me about that was just how the finish just kind of seemed to come out of nowhere, which I actually like. I have no problem with that. You catch a guy with a powerbomb, match is over. It does. Not every match needs to be built around this escalating near fall and multiple finishers and multiple near falls. I have no real issue with that. Steamboat and Pillman had a fun match early in the show. That was nice.
Good one, yeah. So it's not but the main matches, the top ones, all like I said, it could have been a lot better on paper. It seemed like it would have been a lot better. And then and WCW really, they had some decent things going into early '93, and it wasn't like I feel like if Watts had been able to survive, it could have been a good promotion for a while, but it could have had like a more firmer direction and more focused and more rather than just kind of being haphazard like WCW often would be pre Hogan, kind of lacking focus, lacking a direction, or so forth. Watts would have brought that and probably would have brought some good ideas and so forth. Despite Watts being a guy who was very set in his ways and has some ideas about wrestling that kind of feel like were out of date at the time, particularly in his handling of Pillman and going away from the light heavyweights, who were kind of a highlight of the early part of '92, and some of the other things,
Yeah, absolutely. And, this card kind of, just it was like that, and for people who don't know the order of the matches, you go from the 30-minute time limit draw for the unified tag titles. Then you've got this convoluted mess of the NWA world title match, which had, I kind of appreciated how they made it a spectacle. I get that. I kind of like that vibe. But like I said, it just kind of was, the crowd didn't really seem to, pop for it. And then you had Race inside the ring as a referee, and then Sasaki, I think, outside the ring. You have both guys get bumped, and it was just, it was just kind of all over the place. Yeah. And then you get Ron Simmons, who has a really cool entrance with his, that Jesse Ventura even likens to Muhammad Ali winning the title and getting a entourage. Right. He's got this really cool entrance, but again, he's taking on Barbarian, who I am a big fan of, but again, wasn't really bought as a WCW World Champion, contender. And then that match just kind of ends out of nowhere after, not really ever clicking either. A match like that could certainly work. I'm not against a good punch kick match, between two big dudes, but at the same token, that one just never really got going.
Sure. And also the whole trying to do two world titles was not a good idea. Like, I get the idea that, like, you feel like the NWA has that credibility and you want to get back with that, but they were better off. And history, I mean, it's easy to say in hindsight that, yeah, they didn't really need the NWA title, that it really wasn't necessarily adding that much to them. And I don't really think it added that much at the time, although I wasn't really a fan of WCW at the time, so maybe there were, I don't know if I have the mentality of that fan base to be able to say, like, you know, oh yeah, bringing it back meant something to a group of people. Maybe it did, but I just kind of feel like, you know, they'd already established that WCW identity and had made that move. Why muddle things with more titles and you know, and more organizations and more initials and blah blah blah.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, and I'm a guy who has no problem with the current day WWE having the WWE title, world title, even the US and intercontinental titles, even though those should be used better. I have no problem with that, but I agree in this scenario, it made no sense to have two top titles like
right,
that.
Right. So, all right. Anything else before we get into the Twitter questions?
No, I think that's about it. It was a decent show. It looked like it would be a lot better on paper than it turned out to be, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it was certainly interesting. Like I said, the things that jumped out at me was how good the announcing was and how awful Missy Hyatt was, who I meant to mention earlier.
Yes.
I'm sure I know why I didn't notice this when I was a kid, but her delivery was like, it looked like she'd never been on TV before.
Yeah, Missy Hyatt was strange. The appeal there, you know, other than her breasts, I don't, you know, to put it bluntly, I don't really see why Missy Hyatt was someone who was, who had great appeal to people, but, you know, but apparently she did. So.
Yeah. And certainly not to sidetrack this too much, but, I noticed Johnny Gunn was in that six-man title, and I have no recollection of that guy. So I looked it up, and apparently he's the guy that played he's Tom Brandy, who played Sal Sincere.
Yes.
And I don't remember anything about Johnny Gunn ever existing in WCW, so I'm going to have to do some more research about his time there, because that was complete news to me when I saw him.
Yeah, I don't think he lasted long, because I remember sort of looking him up when I was doing – I went through a lot of the Halloween Havocs last year, and I was tweeting them, and I remember coming across him and being kind of surprised, you know, vaguely surprised as well. But it didn't last too long. There's also an even more random six man at the Havoc 93. I'll just mention it real quick. It's Ice Train, Charlie Norris, and the Shockmaster against Harlem Heat not long after they debuted, and the Equalizer.
And wait, was the Equalizer, was that Dave
it was,
Sullivan?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
So
I knew he was somebody that I knew from, I knew he was somebody, but I could not exactly remember.
Right.
Who.
So, and actually, it's kind of a decent match, believe it or not, despite having a lot of guys in it who weren't good. But anyway, so to the Twitter questions, Tom Holzerman at T Holzerman asks, is Sting versus Roberts the biggest mismatch in intelligence ever? What do you think?
Well, I think you answered that question by asking yourself this. Did Samoa Joe ever wrestle anybody smarter than Jake Roberts? Because, you know, obviously Samoa Joe gets a lot of heat for being the modern day Sting as far as blindly trusting people when he has no reason to do so.
Okay.
I'm tempted to say that, my buddy TH is absolutely correct. That probably is. You got Jake, the master manipulator, just dealing with a guy who, you know, blindly trusted anybody, including guys like Ric Flair, who continually messed him over.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a good call on that.
I assume that Jake Roberts and Eugene never wrestled.
I don't believe so.
You know. So, that's the only thing I could think of, you know. Dutch Lombrowski, how many folks bought in and then cashed out on WCW due to the coal miner glove stipulation? I would say, I mean, that's kind of the evidence is there. They sort of popped an extra buy rate with the show, and then I don't think they were able to continue that momentum. So I'm guessing that they got some curiosity for the show, and maybe not just the coal miner's glove, but that, maybe the fact that the whole show was kind of disappointment, and then them not being able to follow up on Robert and Sting due to Robert's leaving probably lost an audience. I mean, I imagine most of the audience that they gained was probably there because of Roberts.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I mean, I think most of the blame probably does have to go on that coal miner's stip, but as we just talked about, there was a lot of issues with this
Sure,
show.
sure. Let's see. And Rich Thomas at Earth Dog, how do you feel about a non-title match as the main event with other title matches on the card?
I personally have no real issue with it. Now, I'm as big a fan of the whole concept of, say, champion should always be introduced second. That's one of those kind of old school things that people sometimes get all hung up on. I think this non-title match being the main event is another one that people really seem to have an issue with, and I can certainly respect why they do. Me personally, if you've got a hot enough feud or a big enough match, I don't necessarily adhere to the idea that you have to main event your show with a title match, even if you do have titles defended on the show.
Yeah, I completely agree. I would say I would usually think a title match should be the main event of the show, but certainly there's a lot of exceptions to that, and this certainly fits the bill because it was definitely the most important, biggest thing, most interesting thing on the show. It was a big grudge match, and so yeah, it makes complete sense as the main event. So I feel like I mean, I feel like most important story trumps title, but I do feel like you probably to maximize the value of your title, you generally want your most important story to be involve the title. But not always.
Right. Yeah, and I can go either way on that, 'cause sometimes, especially at WrestleMania, for example, I kind of like it sometimes when, say we get The Rock versus Cena as a big match and then you get a title match. Sometimes the title helps to give other people stuff to do, for lack of a better term, but yeah, I mean, I could certainly see that. You don't always want to keep your you certainly don't want to have a situation where your top act is never anywhere near your title,
Right.
And you certainly want your titles to matter. So, I kind of fall somewhere in the middle on that one, but
Yeah.
yeah, I think it's a good point.
Right. I agreed. And Mass Tweeter, I think he's being facetious, but he's asked, did JR mention that the match was between two different eras of Mid-South UWF? He did not, but that's certainly something he would have known, and kind of an interesting observation. Even though Sting and Roberts were only separated by a few years in Mid-South, those do feel like very different eras of Mid-South UWF.
Absolutely. I wouldn't have even really thought of it that way. So Masked Tweeter's got a good point
Yeah.
there. It would have been funny, which it would have been counterproductive, mind you, but had JR somehow sort of mentioned that maybe a friend of Sting's had some bad dealings with Jake recently, that might have been kind of amusing, of course
Oh
alluding
yeah.
to the Ultimate Warrior
Right.
situation with the bury me Snake Man, which I want to mention as much as I can in
Sure.
this episode.
I didn't the Jake Roberts Ultimate Warrior is something that I must have been during like a period in which I wasn't watching much, so that wasn't something that I saw until years later. But wow, how wonderful that is. Wonderfully bad maybe, but still wonderful.
Absolutely.
And then the last question by Ryan Foster at Foster versus World. Do you think Sting fulfilled his potential as a babyface headliner, or could he have been bigger? And it's a little bit of a loaded question. There's a lot of, I guess it depends on what you mean by could have been bigger. But I'll let you answer first.
Yeah, I think Sting, you know, what he had one of his chases for the title derailed with that knee injury, I believe, because he was not champion when he suffered that injury, I don't
No,
believe.
No, yeah, it was although I feel like you finish your point and then I'll address.
Yeah, I'm trying to think in general, I'm trying to think how long it took. I'm wondering if ultimately the bigger issue, at least early on, was maybe he should have captured the title sooner after the, what was it, 45-minute match with Flair that made him at Clash 1.
Yeah.
Then the chase, of course, being derailed with the knee injury, that's just one of those freak things. You know, it certainly doesn't help that you put him in there against a guy like Jake that seems like it's going to be, you know, a situation where you could really get Sting and Jake and the promotion over, and, you know, you deliver this on at this pay-per-view. So ultimately, Sting, I will say, Sting kind of falls in that category, and I'm a huge fan. He's a top 10 favorite wrestler of all time. He is probably one of those guys that is a big deal that probably could have been at least a slightly bigger deal.
Yeah, I agree that I think if Sting had won the title sooner, it might have made a bit of a difference. I think Sting early in his career suffered in comparison to Flair because, almost no one can compare to Flair, and Sting couldn't. And then there was a segment of fans in WCW who were unwilling to accept anything other than Flair, even though Flair had been on top for so long that they needed fresh blood. There was that whole contradiction for a long time, which led to WCW being indecisive about it and led to, you know, just the company declining in popularity because they couldn't find someone to succeed Flair, and the returns for Flair were diminishing for several years until they brought in Hogan, and that, you know, made, and that was a fresh matchup for the environment. I don't know. I mean, the derailment of Sting as champion, I mean, the knee injury put him out for 4 months, and it's been explained to me that even though it was only 4 months, it really was a big deal because it was really that time did make a difference, and Flair had to wrestle, or Luger had to turn face again to feud with Flair for a while, which hurt Luger's momentum as a heel since he really had a strong thing going there, and Luger could have been Sting's first challenger, and that could have been a big deal. But it was 4 months, and it's hard for me to understand how 4 months really made that much of a difference in Sting's career. I will say that based on Sting's talent, I think that he achieved about as much. I mean, you know, he's been, you know, he's a 25-year, or more than that, really, career. He's to 25 years as a pretty constant main eventer. Now, the companies he's worked for the vast majority of the time have not been super successful, with the exception of, you know, a couple of years of WCW that was extremely successful, and he had a lot to do with that, although, you know, he did spend a lot of that time also not really wrestling, and, you know, obviously it was a very unique character, so he deserves some credit for it, but I think, you know, he had lots of good matches, a handful of great ones, I think was about as successful as you would expect based on his talents. You know, he has obviously limitations in his interviews and promos were never, you know, really that fantastic. They were kind of better later in his career. And he kind of, I do appreciate that he did some things to try to reinvent himself in TNA rather than just sort of coasting on his laurels, which he kind of did for a few years in WCW and maybe early on in TNA. But I kind of think, like, given the companies he worked for and given the timing, I don't think that there's all that much that would have been, that could have been done that really would have made a difference. Now, you know, maybe if he'd gone WWF in 1990, or maybe that would have made a difference, but maybe, you know, maybe he wouldn't have worked there either. I mean, you know, who knows? But I kind of get the sense that Sting basically, for the most part, reached his potential.
Yeah, and it is quite remarkable that he had the career he had, considering his limited promo skills, which you mentioned. I mean, it's really pretty remarkable.
Yeah, right. I mean, and even though his talking wasn't good, he did have charisma. He did have the kind of, like, in the ring, he could engage people in the match, and people loved his look, and he had personal charisma. He just didn't have the ability to communicate all that well in interviews, I guess happens. I mean, it wasn't like terrible, but it certainly wasn't like he wasn't anywhere near the league of some of the great promo guys of his time, or either of the eras. That I guess he's sort of been a reasonably important part of three eras of professional wrestling, so it's hard to argue against that.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. He's certainly had a heck of a run. Deserves the legend tag, so good for him.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, anything else that you can think of to bring up about the situation?
No, like I said, the commentary really is what I walked away the most impressed with, and I almost need to use these three initials because I know some wrestling fans have such an aversion to it, but it kind of reminded me of MMA commentary, and that you listen to them and they discuss things that pertain directly to the match, that pertain to strategies on how a guy might be thinking, or what a guy might need to do to win a match. I think that wrestling companies nowadays really need to think about how they use their commentators to help get their product over and get people connected to their product better than they have been the last few years.
Sure. So anything you would like to plug?
Well, obviously I post on South Atlanta Wrestling. It's a blog. I post as Freebird STF. That's my username on at least one wrestling message board of South Atlanta Wrestling. Typically, you can find it just by Googling it. There's not a lot of things related to that, but it's freebirdstf.blogspot.com. I try to keep fresh content up there pretty much daily. Sometimes it's bite-sized, sometimes it's a little more drawn out, but certainly swing by the blog. I'll be tweeting from the South Atlanta Wrestling Twitter feed, which you should have seen earlier today, or earlier before the show, or during the show even. So give me a follow, check out Facebook, check out the blog. It's just basically the whole premise of it's just a guy who has been a lifelong wrestling fan talking about things that interest him. So you may not get 5-paragraph essays about why it's a certain match was so good, but you might get, hey, this shirt's really cool, and here's why I think it's cool. So, if you're like mine, you're like me, and you like wrestling figures, wrestling shirts, just wrestling in general, swing by, check it out. Let me know what you think. Always love to hear some feedback.
Right. Well, definitely. I always appreciate – I always enjoy seeing your tweets, and I check out your blog sometimes, and always appreciate your points of view. And thanks again for being on the show. And
it was all my pleasure.
And thanks everyone for listening. Of course, again, check out our sponsor, GredenzaPress.com. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Leave some feedback on iTunes. Appreciate a rating and a review. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher. Please be checking us out. We'll have more shows coming along the pipeline, so just keep looking out for them. So thanks again, everyone, for listening, and have a wonderful day.